The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the hosts or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
It's time to bring out the Better Worldian in all of us. Welcome to Better Worldians Radio with your hosts, Ray, Mary Sue, and Gregory Hansel. Better Worldians Radio inspires you with the people and ideas that are making the world a better place. You'll hear how small acts can make a big difference every day. Now, here are Ray, Mary Sue, and Gregory.
Hi, this is Ray Hansel. Welcome to Better Worldians Radio. Better Worldians Radio is a weekly broadcast whose mission is to uplift and inspire you to make the world a better place. Every week, we are speaking with best-selling authors, film producers, TED speakers, happiness experts, and also everyday folks just like you, people whose small acts make a big difference. And that's why we call them Better Worldians. And speaking of Better Worldians, let me now introduce you to my co-hosts, Mary Sue Hansel and Gregory Hansel. Mary Sue has been a successful entrepreneur and business executive for over 30 years. She's also an avid practitioner of the healing arts, positive psychology, and spirituality. And now, my life partner, Mary Sue.
Hi, everyone. It's great to be here with you today to share all the good that's being done in the world. Now, let me also introduce Gregory Hansel. Gregory has a background in philosophy and world religions, and most importantly, has spent over 15 years at the intersection of technology, social causes, and big ideas.
Hi, this is Greg. I'm so glad you can all join us here on Better Worldians Radio. Let me first just tell you a bit about my dad, Ray, who you just heard from. He's a serial entrepreneur who successfully founded and with Mary Sue took public a national marketing firm. Giving back has always been really important to Dad, who supports many causes, especially disadvantaged children and their families. By the way, we're the family team that created the popular social game on Facebook called A Better World. It rewards players for doing good deeds while helping to raise money and awareness for charities. To date, over 25 million good deeds have been done in A Better World by more than 2.7 million people. And in the month of April, we're supporting Northern Children's Services, a nonprofit that supports the healthy development of children while stabilizing their families to build stronger communities. When our players complete 300,000 good deeds in the game this month, we'll release funds to the Mother's Fresh Start program to fill welcome suitcases for new moms in need with personal care and baby necessities, including clothes for mom and baby. This week on Better Worldians Radio, we're discussing the best-selling book, Essentialism, The Disciplined Pursuit of Less, with author Greg McEwen. Greg writes, teaches, and lectures around the world on the importance of living and leading as an essentialist. He has spoken at companies including Apple, Google, and Facebook, and is among the most popular bloggers for the Harvard Business Review and LinkedIn's influencer group. He co-created the course Designing Life Essentially at Stanford University and serves as a young global leader for the World Economic Forum. Greg holds an MBA from Stanford University. Hi, Greg. Welcome to Better Worldians Radio.
I'm just so happy to be with you.
Thank you for coming. Thank you for being here. So you say essentialism is the disciplined pursuit of less. What does that mean?
Well, you know, really what it means is to not just pay lip service to the idea of, prioritizing now and then, every so often, as if it's one more thing we have to stuff into our already overstuffed lives.
Mm-hmm.
It's about a continual, perpetual, disciplined, ongoing, ever-present pursuit of the essential instead of the undisciplined pursuit of the non-essential.
Mm-hmm. So in what way does essentialism go against the modern workplace culture?
In every way. No, seriously, it I knew that this book was countercultural when I wrote it, but it has proved to be far more countercultural than even I appreciated in putting it together.
Mm-hmm.
I got a call. Actually, it was from NPR, the national radio station, and and somebody there said, listen, I haven't read Essentialism, but my boss's boss has, and I just want to know if what they're doing is what you said for them to do. and what they meant by it was that maybe this person suddenly seemed like they were acting in a way so different than what they usually did, mm-hmm. that it was slightly freaking everybody out. And that's because today we live in a busyness bubble,
yeah.
where almost everybody is not just connected, but hyper-connected, where everybody sort of seems to think, if I can just fit it all into my schedule, then I can have it all in my life.
Right.
And the reality is that they can't, but that seems to be the dominant logic and dominant culture of our times.
Yeah. No, I think that's true. And I think it can be tricky to be able to say no in a workplace, but we'll get to that in just a minute. You begin your book, Essentialism, with the story of Sam Elliott, which really illustrates your point that you can do more by doing less. So can you share that story?
This is a true story. A leader based here in Silicon Valley who was doing award-winning work for one company, and then that whole company got purchased by a larger, more bureaucratic firm. And as he went into the new company, he was keen to be a team player.
Mm-hmm.
And what he meant by that loosely was say yes to everyone and everything,
right.
without really thinking about it. And what he noticed is that his stress was just going up at exactly the same time as the quality of his work was going down.
Sure.
And that led him to almost think about leaving the company, but somebody gave him some counterintuitive advice. And the advice was, retire in role. And what they meant was not quit, stay, and don't tell anybody, but pretend that you're only going to get paid for the value you actually create into this company. And suddenly he said, well, being invited to a meeting didn't seem like a good enough reason for going.
That's great.
And so he didn't. Well, what happened? Well, by the end of that year, he said, I got my life back.
Mm-hmm.
He said, at work, my performance evaluations went up, and I ended the year with one of the largest bonuses of my whole career. Now, you can take that to mean different things. But you could say, well, this is a problem of N equals one. This is one person, Greg, you know, yes, you've got an example, but that doesn't show that it's true for everybody else. That's mm-hmm. one interpretation of the story. Another is that this is something far more universal, basic arithmetic, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
And that is this, that you can either do a few things superbly well, or you can do very many things averagely well.
Yeah.
And he suddenly discovered that by doing a few things superbly well, he could actually have a better life at home and a better life at work, make a higher contribution. So that's, I think, not just true for him. I think it's true universally for everyone.
No, I think that's exactly right. And as we were talking about before we started the show, I've experienced that in my own life. I know that you write that essentialism is basically less but better. How difficult can it be to convince people that doing less can be better?
Well, actually, I don't find it hard to convince people of this. I find it almost universally, people accept that there is a fundamental trade-off in life, that they can either do, as we mentioned before, a few things superbly well, that is less but better, or they can do very, very many things averagely well. And then they will be stretched too thin at work or at home.
Mm-hmm.
Then they will be, feel busy but not productive. Then they will find that their inbox is getting longer by the end of the day than it is at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm.
This is an experience people know because it's what they really live day in and day out. Now,
mm-hmm.
here's the thing. Convincing people that there is a better way than that is not hard. But here's what makes the principle of essentialism hard to live in practice is that that's so not what everyone is doing right now.
Yeah.
So it's not the path of least resistance. And so, exactly. So the path of least resistance is to be pulled in a million directions. And so really people are so, that they're getting conned in a way,
mm-hmm.
By the idea that they can have it all. Whereas if they actually were being constantly given two clear options, well, today, would you like to do a few things superbly well? Or would you like to do a lot of things averagely well? They would choose a few things superbly well if they were being given that option. But because that isn't the option that they are given, because it's not presented that way, they fall into this undisciplined pursuit of more. They fall into a path that they wouldn't have deliberately and strategically chosen, but they are choosing by default.
Hmm. Have you heard from people that they have a difficult time kind of bringing, you know, this insight into their workplace and into their everyday lives, or have they had a good time, an easy time enacting it once they really give it a go?
I've had definitely two types of experience that people have had.
Mm-hmm.
But I am the first to put out there that I think essentialism is so countercultural. You can't do it alone. I suppose, you know, there are exceptions to this, but I definitely wouldn't advocate it. I think the military have a phrase that they say, one is none, and two is one, meaning WON, as in winning.
Right.
You've got to do this with somebody else. You've got to have somebody, not just that sort of keeps you honest in a sense of, accountability,
mm-hmm.
but keeps you inspired that they are an aspiring essentialist and you're an aspiring essentialist. I go to breakfast with a couple of people who are in this category, and every time I'm with them, they inspire me to, it can be done. There's a different way. There's a better way. And they're trying essential experiments in their lives. Just at breakfast, and it's a small example, but it's illustrative. Somebody saw, how many cards I brought, not in a wallet because I don't use a wallet, but I had it just, in an elastic band. And I thought that was fairly essentialist. And they said, these two cards, one, my ID and one credit card. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly seeing somebody living a simple, albeit a small thing, made me think, well, what am I doing with all of these others? I don't need it. It's not necessary.
Yeah.
And so I was able to simplify what I was doing. So I think what people have to do is, if they read essentialism and they find themselves saying, I would prefer this alternative path, this way of the essentialist, then they ought to find at least one other person who they think they can take with them on this journey so that they can help each other be inspired and fresh for this journey.
That's interesting. I know you learned an important lesson about essentialism on the day your daughter was born. Can you share that story?
So this was a few years ago now,
mm-hmm.
and I got an email from my boss at the time, and she said, Friday would be a very bad time for your wife, Anna, to have a baby. I should say that my wife was expecting.
Otherwise,
that would have been even odder emails received.
That's right.
But sure enough, Friday came, and that is when our daughter was born. And I was in the hospital, and my wife is looking radiant. The baby is healthy, but instead of being so focused on this clearly essential moment in life, I was pulled in two different directions, and as every non-essentialist will. I was trying to fit both in. How can I do both was the question I was trying to ask. How can I do both? And then I thought, no, I know about leadership. I've studied this for years. I know what to do. But actually, I managed just to say yes and go. I failed.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to the meeting. And I remember that my boss at the time said afterwards, the client will respect you for the choice you made.
Yeah.
Look, I don't think that the look on their faces evinced that kind of confidence.
Mm-hmm.
And furthermore, even if it had, surely I had made a fool's bargain. And that was really where I learned this simple lesson, but one that, you know, I paid a price for, which is that if you don't prioritize your life, someone else will.
Mm-hmm.
And that is really what gives me fire for the deed. You know, it took me a little while after that, not years and years by any means, but it took me a little while to finally just say, I can't do this. This isn't the right direction for me, for my family, for what I'm trying to do. And so I left. I started a business specifically focused on this issue. And that's out of that work came the book Essentialism. You know, the book became a New York Times bestseller. It's been published. It just came out a year ago today, in fact.
Brilliant. That's great.
Published in a dozen countries, traveling around the world, seeing thousands of people, certainly thousands, tens of thousands of people now, who have communicated and said, yeah, this is relevant to me. This is my challenge, too. And I say that just because I feel a sense of mission with this.
Sure.
That it's not just a book. It's personal to me, and it's something that I think many people can relate to.
No, I think that's exactly right. You know, when I read the book, one of my takeaways was not just that this would be great in kind of my tasks and to-do lists, both in my personal and work life, but also that really this is a book about finding meaning and purpose in your life, because it does help reduce that clutter and get to the essence of the matter. We have to head into break in just a second. I wanted to ask you one more question before we do, because you're talking about needing to prioritize your own life. So tell our listeners about the power of choice as you discuss it in the book.
Well, it just goes directly to what we were just talking about. I, you know, how did I find myself in a position that I would allow somebody else to prioritize my life to that extent? And it happens drip by drip that we give up our power to choose. And what's interesting is that we cannot give away our ability to choose. This is inherent. This is forever. This is, innate part of what it means to be human. So what we do instead is we forget that we have the power to choose. So there are these forces in our lives that really are selling to us the idea, you have to do these things. You know, I say so, you have to. Other people are doing it, you have to. People are doing it on Facebook, you have to. And this idea, this mantra is sold to us and we're buying it without realizing we're buying something. Mm-hmm. So this remembering that we have the ability to choose, not just knowing that logically, but knowing it in our hearts makes a big difference. I was at law school 16 years ago and I logically knew I didn't have to be there, but emotionally I have to be there.
Sure.
I signed up, that's all I had time, energy, money, all that. And it was only when I was traveling here to the U.S. for a friend Sean's wedding did I have the space to suddenly feel this emotional freedom. You don't have to. You have a choice. And so I quit law school. And really, that was the day that I discovered I'm supposed to teach and write. That's what I'm supposed to spend my life doing. And it was when I made the mistake with my wife and a daughter that I realized what I ought to be teaching about.
We need to take a break, but before we go, I want to take a moment to congratulate the players in our Better World game on Facebook for reaching our charity partner goal of the month in March. Because you completed 300,000 good deeds in the game, we are releasing funds to Cancer Schmancer to provide cancer screenings to 25 women in need. Great work, Better Worldians! Mary Sue will talk more with Essentialism author Greg McEwen when we come back in just a minute. We'll be right back.
Ask the experts. Call toll-free right now, 1-866-472-5787.
Hello?
And ask our all-star team to answer your question. That's 1-866-472-5787.
Thank you for calling.
VoiceAmerica.com.
In 1987, some inner-city first graders were promised a college education. Now, this promise didn't come from a wealthy corporation. It came from Oral Lee Brown, who saved a large portion of her modest income every year for these children.
She said, well, Ms. Brown, you can't do everything. I said, no, but we need to do more.
And she did more by sending 19 kids to college, helping others pass it on. From the Foundation for a Better Life at values.com.
I've always wanted a neighbor just like you.
I've always wanted to live
in a neighborhood with you.
So let's make the most of this beautiful day.
Since we're together, we might as well say,
would you be mine?
Could you be mine?
Won't you be my neighbor?
My neighbor?
Mr. Rogers passed along friendship in his neighborhood, hoping we would do the same. So let's get started. Friendship. Pass it on. From the Foundation for a Better Life at values.com.
She didn't just visit the sick and poor. She moved in with them. It wasn't convenient, and it wasn't pretty, but they needed help. 12 more then joined this saint of the gutters. They were soon followed by over 4,000 other nuns who gave healing care in orphanages, AIDS hospices, and charity centers. Mother Teresa couldn't do it all, but she gave her all. Compassion. Pass it on. From the Foundation for a Better Life at values.com.
How can we make it a better world?
I think we can make it a better world if we had peace among each other.
Everybody needs to help their neighbor, and then it will spread from then on.
I should do more.
I could do more. I spend so much time on Facebook.
How much time do I spend on Facebook?
Probably more than I should be spending.
I would definitely get back if I could find the time.
Now you can help others just by playing a game on Facebook. It's called A Better World. Share your hopes and dreams. Do good deeds. Make a difference. And have fun. Become a better worldian. Join a community where all good deeds get rewarded. Log in today to find out how you can make a difference every day.
For more information, visit facebook.com/abetterworld.
Streaming live, the leader in internet talk radio, voiceamerica.com.
This is Better Worldians Radio with a family team of Ray, Mary Sue, and Gregory Hansel. To connect with the show today, please call us at 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. You may also send us an email to radio@betterworldians.com. Now, back to Better Worldians Radio.
You're listening to Better Worldians Radio. We're speaking with Essentialism author Greg McEwen. Greg, you write about the importance of taking the time and space to focus. Can you share the story of Bill Gates's Think Week and what the benefits there are?
Well, so this is a story that's been covered in a few ways, but this was when Bill Gates was at the peak of Microsoft's domination. He's under incredible pressure from every angle. I mean, you can just imagine how many people are trying to get a piece of his time. And in the midst of all of that pressure, he still, every 6 months, would take a week for what he called Think Week. And what he would do with that is he would be reading constantly. So he might read as many as 80, 90 different papers about trends in technology, you know, what he needed to understand, where things might be going. And so he had this discipline, and he goes to a specific location, for years, a secret location that he would go to away from everybody and everything so that he could think. And while I'm not sure that it's realistic for everybody to be able to just take a week every 6 months to do that, I think the principle is true that if we want to focus, then we have to escape from our normal environment to focus. And I mean, what I really recommend people do, what I think the very best way is to start applying essentialism, is to take a personal quarterly offsite. So every 90 days, take a day out of the office, away from technology, away from distraction, and to sit and to really review the past. What have I spent the last 90 days doing? How things going? And come up and identify the one, two, maybe as many as three things that we think are really essential for the next 90 days. And to also decide what things to trade off, which things won't we do right away, which things can wait till later. They're really good. They're really interesting. They might really be very important, but you just can't get to them yet.
Yeah, I think that's
And if people – go ahead, yeah.
No, I think that's a great idea because we're just so pulled in all directions in our business life and our personal life. I can imagine Bill Gates, my heavens, with the responsibility that he had, why he had to do that. But we're really not that much different.
Well, I think this is exactly right. As the CEO of our own lives, we seem to often approach the primary challenge that a CEO has in an odd way. Mm-hmm. The primary challenge every CEO has is resource allocation. They have finite resources and an infinite number of ways to be able to use those resources. So right. you can choose how you want to, you know, put your time and energy out there. But as the CEO of our own lives, we seem to often approach that challenge by just making a millimeter progress in a million different directions instead of being able to say, well, I'm just going to focus on the one, two, or three things for the next 90 days that I know will really take me to the next level.
Yeah, you know, you make another very interesting point in the book about that we really need to take the time to play. Tell us more about that, because I think everybody would be interested. Everybody kind of feels guilty with everything going on just to take the time to play. Maybe they think they shouldn't be doing that. Why do you think they should?
Well, look, you know, humans are the ultimate players in the very best sense. And often in a very particular version of the industrial age view of how people should be productive, mm-hmm. play got eliminated. So
yeah.
the industrial revolution took place and the factory system took hold, all of the modern organizations that were built in the factory with a factory logic in mind. I mean, schools today look like factories. People sit in rows. You're trying to get people through a system. It's age-based. It's like a batch system. Children can learn in a whole variety of ways, right? And in fact, you see a trend often now where recess is being reduced and reduced in many different schools in favor of more test time, more memorization, more rote learning, and so on. Mm. And this has the risk of killing the very hunger that comes so naturally to children, which is to learn, is to play, is to explore. So for children, play is the work of a child. And really, I think I'm making the argument, and the research is very strong on this, that the play is also the work of adults too. That we ought not to be thinking so much about work life and then separately play life. We ought to be thinking of our lives more as play, more as creation, innovation, testing things out, trying things, exploring. This is a critical part. It's not that we, play is essential in and of itself. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, here's one of my favorite things that you talk about in the book, and that's about sleep. That sleep is one of the first things that get compromised, that people give it up. I like the fact that you say it's so important. Tell us why it's so essential.
Well, the science is very strong on this. I mean, if you have 4 hours of sleep, you're pretty much the same as if you were drunk.
Oh, jeez.
Your cognitive abilities are so reduced. Your ability to discern what matters and what doesn't, what's essential and what's non-essential, what is trivial versus what is vital, is massively reduced. And so this whole idea, again, an extension of the industrial age productivity mindset, which says an hour less sleep equals an hour more productivity, may be true for a machine, but it is not true for for the human animal. And yet, I was just talking to somebody just the other day, and they said, "Oh, Greg," they said, I am so busy." They said, and they're smiling.
Oh.
"I'm so busy. I'm so busy." They said, "I have slept on average 4 hours a night for the last 2 weeks." And, and my sense was they didn't know they were talking to, you know, an essentialist. because I was not impressed. And in sort of the funnest, nicest way possible, I sort of started to explain that to her. And she emailed me a couple of weeks later and she said, "You know, I am getting my 8 hours and what a difference it is making." Now, this is somebody who's capable. They're driven. They have been very successful. All of those things. But what they've also got is an idea that they've been sold that turns out to be a bill of goods.
Mm.
They believe this idea. If you can just fit it all in, you can have it all. If you believe that, if that's true, then just sleep less. Shove more into your schedule. Do more, and you will accomplish more.
And you certainly would be very, very grouchy too, wouldn't you?
You would be grouchy, but it's a lot. You're actually right, but it goes a lot more than that. What you'll be is you'll plateau in your progress.
Mm-hmm.
You will get far less accomplished of what matters.
Yeah, that's
you'll be far more likely to constantly be in an addictive cycle with email, where all you're doing is reacting to the next request because you don't have the cognitive ability, space, discernment to be able to focus and say, this, all of these things don't really matter. That's the thing I ought to be focused on now. And so you'll get yourself, and we talk about getting into a rat race. That's exactly what produces it. Sleep deprivation equals lack of discernment equals reacting to requests that are being made that may or may not be important. And so it goes, and the cycle continues.
You know, I really like the idea that you talk about, too, about the extreme criteria. Can you explain to our listeners what that is and how it works?
Okay, I will, but first you have to describe what your closet looks like to me.
Well, my closet lately looks good, but that's only in the last 2 weeks.
Why?
Why?
What happened in the last 2 weeks, yeah.
I organized it. I threw out things that I didn't want to wear. We're thinking about moving, so I thought, I might as well take this opportunity to give to the Purple Heart, you know, the goodwill type people.
Yep.
And before that, I must admit, it was a big mess. You know, things were all in different order, and, you know, only the things I wear more frequently were in the front, and now it's very pleasant. When I go in there, it's all organized. It seems like it has more room. And I felt good because I gave to charity.
You just articulated the argument against non-essentialism and for essentialism.
Oh, that's good.
You just did it.
Oh,
you
good.
Just said that less can be better.
Mm-hmm.
That having the right few things was actually more pleasant for you than having more things of the wrong stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not talking about the our literal closets, although I 100% believe essentialism does apply to that. But I'm talking about the closet of our lives in which we follow, I think, the very same kind of logic, which is a logic that leads someone to say, look, if I just had a larger closet, that would solve the problem. And people think that until they actually end up with a larger closet sometime. And then they realize that they stuff that full as well.
Mm-hmm.
And they suddenly realize, who was at the scene of both crimes? Yeah, it's me.
Mm-hmm.
And they said something I'm doing is leading to this. So what is it that people are doing? And I think it really comes to the idea of being insufficiently selective. So the criteria people often use is they take an item off the shelf and they look at it to think about giving it away. They think, well, maybe sometime in the future it will come back into fashion and I'll wear it again.
Yes.
Or maybe I know this hasn't happened to you, but to me, maybe it'll fit me one day again.
No, we all go through that. Maybe I'll lose a few pounds, so I shouldn't throw it out.
and so we keep these things, and maybe I could wear it sometime. And so because that is basically almost not criteria at all, that's saying if I could ever possibly wear this, then I should keep it. And that is massively too wide criteria. If suddenly somebody changes the question to, for example, Marie Kondo, in her recent book that's been phenomenon, The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up, she suggests this question. She says, ask, does it spark joy? You hold every item in your hands and you say, does it spark joy? And if the answer is no, you're free to pass it on to someone else. Well, so now, can you imagine being that selective in one's life as well? That we say, look, is this the very best use of me? Would I hire me to do this job? You ask, is this what I'm truly passionate about?
Yes.
Is this my essential mission? Is this the highest contribution I could be making? Those questions are complete game changers. I mean, they are so radically different than what people are doing typically. I think of how that's different, how different that is, rather, than the broad criteria like this. If somebody emails me and asks me to do it, then I do it. I mean, that's the kind of criteria that we're really using today. I mean, basically, no matter what anyone does first, the next thing they're going to do is check their phone and check their email. And what we've got to hope, by the way, in that strategy, what we have to hope is that all of the people who are emailing us have colluded together in a room. You know, they got together and they said, we've just got to make sure that we're only using, you know, Mary Sue for her absolute highest contribution. And they've all made sure. They all say, yes, this is how we're going to do it. And we'll all email different things, but that's what it will add up to. Now, that's as you were laughing, it is laughable. Of course, that's not what's happening. And yet we have absolutely outsourced the strategic function of our lives to email. It was just on NPR as part of a piece that they were doing called Brilliant But Bored, implying, in fact, that people ought to challenge themselves not to use their phones and be bored. In fact, allow themselves to be bored because creativity is on the edge of boredom. And this same idea of allowing there to be space so that you can play. And in that same piece, they quoted some research that suggests that what we have given up since we put email on our phones is long-term thinking. Can you imagine?
Oh, geez.
What kind of trade-off that is? We're going to do short-term, instant, reactive, you know, thinking to a request that may have absolutely no relevance to the mission we actually want to pursue in life, instead of long-term thinking. I mean, that's a fool's bargain if ever I heard one. And yet that's exactly what we produce. And I just put that question, this is a pretty big question now, but to put the question, what will a whole society be like that never stops to think, ponder, or make long-term strategic choices?
We need to take a break now. When we return, we'll talk more with Essentialism author Greg McEwen when we come back. If you're a fan of Better Worldians Radio, then you should check out our social enterprise, A Better World, whose mission is to make uplifting games and apps to brighten the world. Our goal with everything we do is have fun, do good, and change the world. We're committed to creating some awesome digital products designed with the purpose of making a difference through optimism, altruism, and charity. And so far to date, over 25 million good deeds have been done in a better world by more than 2.7 million people. You can join in and find out more at abetterworld.com. We'll be right back.
Yeah. Ask the experts. Call toll-free right now, 1-866-472-5787.
Hello?
And ask our all-star team to answer your question. That's 1-866-472-5787.
Thank you for calling.
VoiceAmerica.com.
How can we make it a better world?
I think we can make it a better world if we had peace among each other.
Everybody needs to help their neighbor, and then it will spread from there on.
I should do more.
I could do more. I spend so much time on Facebook.
How much time do I spend on Facebook?
Probably more than I should be spending.
I would definitely get back if I could find the time.
Now you can help others just by playing a game on Facebook. It's called A Better World. Share your hopes and dreams. Do good deeds. Make a difference. And have fun. Become a better worldian. Join a community where all good deeds get rewarded. Log in today to find out how you can make a difference every day.
For more information, visit facebook.com/abetterworld.
She didn't just visit the sick and poor. She moved in with them. It wasn't convenient, and it wasn't pretty, but they needed help. 12 more then joined this saint of the gutters. They were soon followed by over 4,000 other nuns who gave healing care in orphanages, AIDS hospices, and charity centers. Mother Teresa couldn't do it all, but she gave her all. Compassion. Pass it on. From the Foundation for a Better Life at values.com.
I've always wanted a neighbor just like you. I've always wanted to live
in a neighborhood with you.
So let's make the most of this beautiful day.
Since we're together, we might as well say,
would you be mine?
Could you be mine?
Won't you be my neighbor?
My neighbor?
Mr. Rogers passed along friendship in his neighborhood, hoping we would do the same. So let's get started. Friendship. Pass it on. From the Foundation for a Better Life at values.com.
In 1987, some inner-city first graders were promised a college education. Now, this promise didn't come from a wealthy corporation. It came from Oral Lee Brown, who saved a large portion of her modest income every year for these children.
She said, well, Ms. Brown, you can't do everything. I said, no, but we need to do more.
And she did more by sending 19 kids to college, helping others pass it on. From the Foundation for a Better Life at values.com.
Stimulating talk
gets those synapses in the brain firing really fast.
All the time. The number one internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com.
This is Better Worldians Radio with a family team of Ray, Mary Sue, and Gregory Hansel. To connect with the show today, please call us at 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. You may also send us an email to radio@betterworldians.com. Now, back to Better Worldians Radio.
We're back now with Essentialism author Greg McEwen. Hi, Greg.
Hi, it's great to be back with you.
Great to have you on board. I've been listening to the sessions. Wonderful work that you're doing, really needed at this point. So we congratulate you on the work that you're doing. There's a lot of interesting and intriguing stories that you're telling along the way. Tell us a little bit about the boundaries that are important and they're empowering for essentialists.
Well, look, I mean, there's a story that I came across in the research for the book, which I just love, which is of a man who's complaining about his son to a therapist, and saying, you know, he's addicted. He's got all of these problems and issues. We have him staying at our house still. He's you know, full grown out in his 30s now, and he doesn't want to he doesn't contribute properly. He doesn't do what he's supposed to do. And the therapist said, well, where is he today? And he said, well, he doesn't think he has a problem, so I came without him. And the therapist says, I think that he's right. I don't think he does have a problem. And the man is not impressed by this. He said, what do you mean? Mm-hmm. He says, imagine that your next door neighbor's yard is green and it's lush. But it's being watered by your watering system that's faulty. It's gone in the wrong direction. It's watering the next door neighbor's grass. He says, who has the problem? Your next door neighbor have a problem? You have a problem. And they conclude that he has the problem. The father has the problem because he hasn't set any boundaries. And so that's the problem that has to be corrected. Mm. And, of course, we don't all have that kind of extreme situation going on in our lives. Mm-hmm. But what we do have as a huge problem is no boundaries between work and home. None. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And this is just one example. There's lots of examples we could use, but that's an important one. I mean, for the first time, I just received an invitation from someone struggling to find some time to meet for an appointment. Said, it's a work appointment. Could we meet on this Saturday? I turned him down twice for that meeting and said, look, that doesn't work for me. And finally, he offered me a Sunday evening instead. And I just thought, if I give up my Saturday or Sunday for this meeting, I'll never get it back.
No, you'll never get it back. No.
So boundaries are critical.
Yeah. Yeah.
Critical. We talked about Sam Elliott earlier on. It was critical for him in being able to contribute better at work and at home to set boundaries.
You know, I had a situation that was exactly what you just mentioned as an example, which is a neighbor came to me when we were moving some things around and doing some landscaping in a house I had and said, you just cut off the sprinkler system. Apparently, my sprinkler system, because I hadn't owned the house before, was actually sprinkling his water, watering his grass. And he was highly offended that I shut off the water and said, look, we used to give the old neighbor, an occasional dinner or give him a case of beer or something, or a bottle of wine. I said, to thank him for the water. I said, well, I says, he's not here anymore. I said, there are now new boundaries. A new sheriff is in town.
There are new boundaries.
Yeah, there are new boundaries.
But riffing on that for a second, I mean, this is the thing. In the moment, pushing a new boundary is going to create a bit of a relationship withdrawal.
Yes,
because nobody likes to have their relationship altered.
No.
The rules of the game change.
Yes. Yeah, I can validate that, yes.
Yes, but it's the only mechanism by which we can get into healthy, long-term relationships with people that really work, that are really mutually beneficial. And so many of the relationships we're in are only one way. They don't have boundaries. Mm-hmm. In fact, I guess now riffing on this, I remember a story that really hit me hard. This was before the book came out, but after I'd been teaching essentialism to a group, and there was someone who listened to this and she realized, I have never set boundaries with my boss, not in 5 years. Mm-hmm. If my boss asks me to do something, the answer is yes, no matter what, no matter how late at night, no matter how anything. And so she decided she'd try an experiment. She said, okay, I am going, I'm about to get married in 5 weeks. I'm going to go and I'm going to say, look, here's my work. I want to, I'm going to get this stuff done before I leave, but I need 5 days of uninterrupted time to be able to focus and prepare for my wedding. And she negotiated that. She felt empowered. She did it. They came to an agreement. She got the work done ahead of schedule. The boss was pleased. Everything's going well. But then as the 5 days hit, the boss emails her, says, so sorry to do this to you. But someone's dropped the ball. I need you to step up. Mm. But for 5 years, she has taught her boss, that's fine. No problem. Here, for the first time in her life, she says, look, we came to an agreement. This is really essential to me. Mm-hmm. I'm going to choose this and go forth. Well, in the moment, the boss wasn't so pleased about that. She got to spend her 5 days, though, focused on her wedding. Mm-hmm. And was so empowered by the experience that she actually added into her vows, I will essentialize this relationship over all others.
Oh my gosh, it's not going to become part of a religion. Oh,
yeah.
That's amazing.
It's a fundamental part of what they're trying to do now.
Yeah.
What actually ended up happening at work was that the boss ended up having to do that work themselves.
Yeah.
And then they realized that the problem they'd really made as a manager was that they had been always excusing other people's non-performance and giving it to this one employee. Mm-hmm. And so announced to everybody, okay, I'm going to be going through and talking to each of you to really make sure that we have proper expectations. And that's not always how it turns out, but it's a good example of how in the moment it can get worse before it gets better.
Yeah,
but you have to know yourself. You have to get clarity yourself about what matters most. to even be in a position to negotiate with other people.
And how do you recommend that we actually figure out what matters most?
But I think that it's not that complicated.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that complicated. It's mm-hmm. about create. But what is hard is creating space to do it. So I mentioned earlier on this idea of a personal quarterly offsite, and I highly recommend that to people. Mm-hmm. One day, every 90 days, get clear about a few simple questions. You know, mm-hmm. basically, these are the questions. Ask, you know, what is the priority? Personally, my personal priority over the next 90 days.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you get to have just one or two of those. Like, you know, maybe you have a major and a minor. That's mm-hmm. pretty much it.
Yeah.
You're going to focus on for 90 days. And then you say, professionally, what is, you know, essential professionally over the next 90 days? And again, you get a major and a minor.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not saying you absolutely only get one thing and that's it. But I'm saying if you do fewer things more thoughtfully, mm-hmm. then you can make a higher contribution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I found that meditation also helps on a daily basis, although it's not as, I think, as much of a bigger event as you're suggesting a quarterly retreat. Or as Bill Gates does his full think week, I think what it does do is it gives you a little bit of a buffer so that you create some space. And when sort of things start to come over you, whether it's email intensity or some other reactive situation, you sort of step back from that occasionally because you've had this space to create a little bit of a neutral zone for on a daily basis. So
it's absolutely true. I want to play on that for a second. There's somebody that I know that was a very successful executive, but he found himself very stressed all the time. And so he's saying, look, is this what success is like? You know, like I've got to get to a point where success feels better than this. Yeah. And so he started reading all about the mindfulness work, and it's made a huge difference in his life in a variety of ways. But one of the practices he suggests is, you know, for those that have never got into meditation, mm-hmm. is just start every time you sit down at your desk, that's mm-hmm. the trigger, you close your eyes and you give 3 deep breaths.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Just take that moment right there. Yeah, that's great advice.
A tiny change in the pursuit eventually of a more deliberate and developed meditation practice. He'll take often half an hour now.
Mm-hmm.
But he couldn't start with half an hour.
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't believe that he had that kind of control over his schedule. Until slowly he realized, yes, there's a mm-hmm. lot more within my sphere of influence than I'm allowing for.
It sounds like this has changed your life quite a bit.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. And I would go further, though, to say that it's not over yet. Mm-hmm. This is one of the few principles or disciplines that I have ever come across, that I've ever been able to articulate, that doesn't seem to have a point of diminishing returns.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there are a lot of principles. You start applying them and you go, okay, that's good. Don't go too far with that one. Mm-hmm. I don't know how you go too far with essentialism.
Mm-hmm.
You could get principle wrong. You could believe that what I wrote was a book called Noism,
mm-hmm.
say no to everything, mm-hmm. and that would be wrong, but that's not what I wrote. That's not what it's about.
Right. Right.
Yeah, the book is Essentialism. So can you go too far
mm-hmm.
on just focusing on what is essential? No, mm-hmm. I don't think so.
Let me ask you one more question. We're actually going to have to wrap up, believe it or not. We've gotten so carried away here. In speaking about essentialism, we ask this question every week of every one of our guests. What do you hope that by people embracing these principles of essentialist, how that can actually help to make the world a better place?
Well, I mean, I think that essentialism writ large is the very work of life. It's not a sideshow. It's not an add-on. It is what we are supposed to do here, is to constantly be asking, what is my conscience counseling me to do? What is the voice inside saying? Instead of all the noise outside saying, and to perpetually, you know, as we mentioned at the beginning, in a disciplined pursuit of that essential voice and to push other stuff out. I mean, we know quite a lot about what people regret on their deathbeds, because not trying to be too morbid about it, but a lot of people have died, and a lot of people before they died told people what they regretted. And what we know is that their number one regret of the dying is to have lived a life based on other people's noise and expectations instead of our internal voice.
Nobody regrets not getting to that last batch of emails, I suspect. Well, this has been an amazing adventure with you, Greg. We really appreciate your participation on our Better World show today. if for our guest, for our listeners, you can find out more about Essentialism and Greg McEwen's work by going to gregmcewen.com. Greg, we'd like to thank you once again today for joining us on Better Worldians Radio.
Thank you ever so much for having me. Bye for now.
You're very, very welcome. As we end our show each week, we'd like to share our Better Worldians mission. We strive to make the world a better place by encouraging the very best in everyone. We focus on positive thinking, positive values, and positive actions. In short, our vision is to bring out the Better Worldians in everyone so that we can all make it a better world. And so until next time, please be a Better Worldian.
Thank you again for helping make the world just a little bit better this week. Please join your hosts, Ray, Mary Sue, and Gregory Hansel next Thursday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, 8 a.m. Pacific, on the Voice America Variety Channel. We hope we've inspired you to do one small thing to help make a big difference. Join us at BetterWorldians.com to tell us what you've done to change the world.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program, brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the hosts or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.